Badlands. Explain those Badlands. That's a hell of a name.
All right, welcome to this week's episode of Breaking History on Badlands Media, where Gordon and I provide as much historical and epistemological, philosophical context to help shape the things that we're slapped with on social media and the news on a day-to-day basis that often lacks that vital context so necessary to form proper judgments and navigate through this whole terrain of misinformation, disinformation, but not exactly the way that people like Ursula von der Leyen would have it unfold. So how you doing, Gordon?
I'm great, man. I'm great. Got back from California two nights ago. So you can probably tell it's nighttime. So we pre-recorded last week because I was in California for GART, for Badlands GART last Wednesday, and then flew in and have some work stuff going on tomorrow when the show airs. So we are pre-recording this week, but starting going back to, I think, normal schedules next week, we should be fine. But man, great weekend in GART, great weekend in Southern California. A lot of people said a lot of really nice things about you. So I think Matt has a lot of fans out there in the Badlands world.
Well, that's good for my soul to hear. All right, that's nice. Thank you. I wish I could have come down. Unfortunately, here I'm stuck in the northern outpost of Canada, so it's a little difficult sometimes to move around. But I was there in spirit. And today we've got a lot to touch upon. I know you and I were discussing a little bit what would be the most strategic thing to bring up in the short hour. Maybe we can play a little bit longer than an hour, but we still have a limited amount of time. But what would be the most strategic things to bring to the table? And obviously right now, I think on top of people's minds is or should be some of the developments going down in Davos, this thing that happens once a year where a slimy, slimy event that was kicked off back in 1971 occurs, not exactly high level in the sense of Bilderberger group high level, but certainly some major discussions, inner clubs, groups within groups discussing and plotting out some very bad ideas for humanity as a whole more generally. And obviously there's some disputes as well. Not everybody's in accord with what exactly the new emerging system is going to look like, how it's going to unfold. There's some disruptive elements as well that don't like the idea of a unipolar death cult reducing all of civilization to 500 million, I think, is the acceptable consensus amongst the computer models that the creatures of Davos have all agreed upon. Some nations and have organized themselves in such a manner as to reject that idea, as well as rejecting the idea of abolishing their ancient traditions and heritages. So I think that there's a few things that you've observed that I've observed. I don't know if you want to share an element on that first, or should I just play a little clip by Ursula von der Leyen and then jump into it?
No, I think that's a good setup. I'll say that I think the other event that we're going to talk about after Davos is we're going to talk about The Hague, which is the International Court of Justice. And right now, people probably heard about the court case going on there between that South Africa has brought the accusation of genocide against Israel. Both sides have now delivered their arguments in the preliminary hearing, which is just to determine if an injunction or a ceasefire should be imposed by the UN against Israel. It's considered the biggest case ever brought to The Hague. So we'll get into that. I think these two things that we're going to talk about, Davos, this particular episode of Davos, and the Hague situation are directly connected. And mm-hmm. I don't think it's a coincidence that they're unfolding at the exact same moment, but we'll get into that conspiratorial talk in a minute.
Absolutely. So let's do this. How about I jump in with I'll let Ursula echo some of my remarks from the opening intro regarding the fear of disinformation and misinformation, which are such great threats to humanity. And then I want to say a little thing about that, and then we can just expand on some of this, because people could smell certain creeping Orwellian censorship policies creeping around, being bantered about. So here, let's just listen to something from somebody who wants to build trust again. That is the theme of this year's Davos summit, is rebuilding trust, where a bunch of billionaire sociopaths want a big hug.
For the global business community, The top concern for the next 2 years is not conflict or climate. It is disinformation and misinformation, followed closely by polarization within our societies. These risks are serious because they limit our ability to tackle the big global challenges we are facing. Changes in our climate and our geopolitical climate, shifts in our demography and in our technology, spiraling regional conflicts and intensified geopolitical competition and their impacts on supply chains. The sobering reality is that we are once again competing more intensely across countries than we have in several decades. And this makes the theme of this year's Davos meeting even more relevant: rebuilding trust. This is not a time for conflicts or polarization. This is a time to build trust. This is a time to drive global collaboration more than ever before. This requires immediate and structural responses to match the size of the global challenges. I believe it can be done.
I wonder why people would not have trust in the the Borg zombies running our world. I wonder why. Because, I mean, what is she thinking about? I mean, there's obviously this idea that disinformation, misinformation, conspiracy theorizing, which were outlined by Cass Sunstein, the husband of Samantha Powers, in and also one of the advisors to the World Health Organization's behavioral insights team that was part of the whole COVID response apparatus to try to shape people's behaviors. This is a major economic behaviorist, Cass Sunstein, who wrote the conspiracy theory document in 2008, where he outlined what would we do for the dangerous pervasiveness of conspiracy theories, of people losing faith in their governments, and how could governments respond to that? Because this is obviously a major security issue. If people lose faith in the corporate media and the stenographers in the mainstream media, who are basically CIA shills just receiving and passing on memos that they're given from the intelligence agencies, then that might be disruptive. Because what happens if you allow that? Well, this is while Ursula is speaking, you have things like this in Germany, all over the place, farmers doing something to stop the solutions that Ursula is trying to propose to stop global warming, which is shut down food production, destroy farmers. Sorry for that. I just had to show.
Fantastic.
There's so many of these images where Germany as a whole, the farmers are doing just like they did in the Netherlands, just like we saw at the truckers' convoy. They're organizing to shut down the supply chains towards things like Amazon, the retailers. And they're really moving across the board, and it's contagious. So this is the sort of thing that they wouldn't be doing if they did not have access to these disruptive conspiracy theories that are just spreading and spreading. So
yeah.
That's
yeah,
one of the themes of the summit.
Brian and I were on Balance Daily last week, played a video of the farmers spraying their buildings with manure. I don't know if you've seen those. Those yeah. are fantastic. Which I think that's like one of that's probably takes the cake as the best form of protest I've ever seen in my life. Is just hosing down a government building with actual liquid manure is fantastic. I've also seen that. I think the Polish farmers are now teaming up with the German farmers, who are also teaming up with the Dutch farmers. So you actually are seeing like an international order, like come to like collaboration happening. You would think that the World Economic Forum would be very excited about this. I thought they loved, you know, international cooperation. So
beautiful. I love that. Yeah.
Maybe a little piece of advice to them, maybe find somebody as a speaker who doesn't have such like an evil sounding accent like that. You know, I know she can't help it, but maybe just find someone who doesn't really have, I mean, Klaus Schwab, Ursula. It's like these are names that don't really that sound very sinister, and their accents are also very sinister. So just a little small piece of advice.
Yeah, and her father also was a high-level aristocrat who had high-level connections to the Nazi SS, and that's also a problem, too. Not to say that one's sins pass on necessarily to one's children, but when they're carrying out the exact same kinds of depopulation policies and fascist agenda that their parents were doing, then you got to think, well, maybe those lessons she had on daddy's lap were something a little bit more dangerous than just story time. So yeah, you've got definitely this problem of not learning our lessons of the past. And Germany is really an ironic case where you have this massive organization of people, of blue-collar workers, farmers especially, organizing themselves as real citizens must. But then you have this other weird thing of taking down plaques. Like there was just in Dresden, the government of Germany, they basically removed plaques honoring the defeat of Nazis, which involved also removing plaques that recognized or acknowledged the US-led bombing of Dresden, which was bombed back to the Stone Age. Like one of the most beautiful historic cities in the world was bombed to the Stone Age unnecessarily, hundreds of thousands of civilians killed. And it was obviously the Russians that came in and put down the German war machine at the very end of the day, after Elba Day was declared. But that's been removed. So they're actually removing their memories of who was it who destroyed the civilians of Germany, who was responsible. How there's monuments of honoring the Russians, of how the Russians saved Europe, that are being removed across Estonia, across Lithuania, across Ukraine, obviously, across all of the countries, to reshape our idea of what was World War II. Because obviously the Russians were the bad guys in World War II, obviously.
Yeah.
And you got this weird thing. And also Germany's coming out now also endorsing, well, this is going to touch on what we're going to talk about later, Israel in their case right now, defending themselves against genocide claims, which are pretty well-founded. So we got these two discussions, obviously, like weaving together with Ursula presiding over this weird clown show.
I didn't know about the plaque thing. That's very interesting. We won't put the cart before the horse and get into the Hague situation, but that is actually a big part of South Africa's presentation, is basically comparing the bombing in Gaza to the bombing in Dresden, which the United States was obviously a part of. So that's very interesting that they're ripping the plaques down as they're being accused of basically doing that all over again in Gaza. So fascinating stuff.
Yeah, historic ironies, eh? It's rich.
Before we get into the meat of Davos, I wanted to share this real quick. Let me share my screen because I think it'll make it a little more impactful. Sure. Our friend Yuval Harari, probably arguably the most evil person in the world, but this was published yesterday, and he warns that he's warning that Trump's reelection could threaten the global order. I think he actually said, I'm not seeing it in this article, but I saw this on the plane ride home, that his quote was like, he thinks that Trump's going to win the election, and he sees Trump's reelection as a death blow to the global order, as if you didn't already have enough reasons to vote for Donald Trump. Harari is basically saying, if you vote for him, then globalism is going to die, which is fantastic.
Trump should use that for his campaign. Like just
yeah,
put it on his campaign posters.
Yeah. I mean, seriously, it's like that, like, could things get any better? Could things get any better as far as that goes? But so I just wanted to lay that out there, that, and for those who don't understand, Noah Harari is Klaus Schwab's like number one guy. He's like, he is the chief philosopher of the World Economic Forum. He's the one who came up with all these ideas about humans being animals and humans being hackable creatures. And, he doesn't really view human, he doesn't really have a very high opinion of humanity. And most of us are just useless eaters, and useless eaters don't really have a reason to exist. So we should just get rid of them.
Yeah, I mean, he'll deny it and say, oh, but I was only the keynote speaker in like two major Davos summits in 2018 and 20. So I'm not really, it's just a coincidence that people are associating me with, the philosophy of Davos. But it's like, no, he is in some ways almost like I find him almost like a reverse Scarecrow hate absorber in some sense, because he himself is very disposable. You know, like he's kind of he's not a scientist. He's like, I think he's sociologist or something with a maybe a major in history. Just an atheistic, misanthropic, like twat who has been elevated to a status that is beyond his capacities to probably even himself understand why he's been told to just like spew out this transhumanist philosophy and gospel that he believes in, probably believing that he will be maybe granted some privilege as a priest within the new order. But this thing definitely, as far as like this revamped Nazi eugenics, because it's a very specific strain of Nietzschean, you know, the followers of Friedrich Nietzsche. I'm not going to say just by believing Friedrich Nietzsche's philosophy, you're necessarily going to be a Nazi. You won't necessarily be a Nazi. However, one of the preconditions of being a Nazi is to have the belief in a Friedrich Nietzschean worldview of the Übermensch, that there are certain people who have a greater will to power, an ability to impose their will onto the world and have the universe respond to their will by just the force of desire and concentration and thus rigor to impose, making them more of a superior breed. And Nietzsche himself was a supporter of eugenics, of weeding out the unfit, the weak, those born maybe malformed or whatever. He encouraged that way of killing off the weak. And he believed also in the Darwinian idea as well, that the world was just a world of diminishing returns, with the strong species surviving and thriving and destroying the weak ones. So he believed that in a human being's context, or in the context of humanity, that those who would be the so-called elites would thus have the control of the levers of evolution and steer it more to their liking. But what would be their liking? So the idea of people like the leading SS Nazis, they didn't just believe in eugenics as a science. They believed it also as a religion. As Francis Galton said, this must be the foundation of a new global world religion, which shares this idea of eugenics at its root core, though maybe not explicitly. And when Nazism failed to be the successful driving force of a new world order, of a one world government run by a banker's dictatorship back before you and I and probably our parents were even born, that new world order program failed, and they had to rebrand, revamp, retool their entire structure and not call it eugenics, but transhumanism became the name of Julian Huxley. And Julian Huxley was the guy who created the UNESCO in 1946, the United Nations Education, Science, and Cultural Organization. And in it, he lays out, right? Yeah, everyone's probably seen the manifesto that they can read online of UNESCO, that written by Huxley while he was the head of the British Eugenics Society, calling for the need to revamp education, cultural policy in the entire transatlantic West in order to promote an acceptance amongst young people of the need for one world government, as well as the need to accept eugenics under a different name such that the unthinkable could once again become thinkable. And this is something, you know, he's doing while he's at the same time branding and coining the word transhumanism. He's setting up the conservation movement with Prince Philip, with Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, that he's co-founding the World Wildlife Fund with these guys, you know, in 1961. And Prince Bernhard is the guy who's setting up the Bilderberger Group to organize all of the different globalists to basically, you know, revamp the Nazi agenda and do it under a new corporate veneer in the next, you know, decade. So this is what's leading up. This is what's shaping the entire life of Ursula von der Leyen, of Klaus Schwab, of the entire like grouping of Nazi groupies without the same name Nazi that become then the transhumanist wannabe overlords, who themselves are the most intellectually stagnant, pathetic, mediocre individuals who see themselves as wannabe superhuman gods, right? And they're just having this temper tantrum when the world isn't behaving according to their beautiful sacred gospel of what the New World Order was supposed to be, what Agenda 21 was supposed to look like by now. And the schedule is just off. Nations aren't abiding by the perfect, pristine, sacred gospel of depopulation. So it's interesting to see these ruptures.
I'm getting an error. It says that I've lost my connection. So I'm going to back out and come back in.
Fine. Yeah, you're totally good.
Why don't you do an ad read and I'll rejoin.
Okay, but I can hear you.
Yeah, I know it says net, but like I'm trying to surf, like I tried to go to a website and it, like I'm not connected to the internet, it says.
Oh, that's so weird.
My computer says it's connected to the internet, but let me just back out and come back in.
I'll do mad reads. You go for it. Okay. Yep. All right. So while we're waiting for Gordon to fix that, let's go listen to a word from Goldco. Let's go listen to Goldco. Here we are. Okay, Goldco. Skyrocketing inflation, endless war, $31 trillion in debt, $4.7 trillion in new proposed taxes. This government just will not stop. Now they're hiring thousands of new gun-carrying IRS agents in all 50 states. I wonder what for. The truth is, things could get a whole lot worse if you are not protected. That's why we've partnered with the top-rated precious metals company, Goldco. Goldco has helped people like you and me place over $1 billion in gold and silver. For those with retirement accounts, they are offering Badlands Media or Breaking History Watchers supporters up to $10,000 in free silver when opening a qualified IRA account. For cash buyers, you're going to love this. You can get bonus silver just for making a purchase. If you buy $15,000 worth of precious metals, you'll get over $750 in bonus silver. If you buy $25,000, you will get $1,250. Yeah, that's pretty good. This is your opportunity to protect yourself from our out-of-control corrupt government. Go to BadlandsGold.com to learn how you could get started today. Go to BadlandsGold.com. All right. And then the next one is a MyPillow ad. Here we are.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, and I'm here to tell you about my new product from MyPillow. Towels that actually work. Watch this absorbency test. Here's another towel that we randomly went out and bought. Here's one of my towels with a nice design. I don't know if you can see this, but you could line a swimming pool with this. I mean, this is crazy. Get rid of it. Towels that actually work. What a concept. I'm interrupting this commercial to let you know you can get our six-piece My Towels, regular $69.98, now only $29.98. Or you can save 25% on our brand new kitchen towels made with the same technology as our famous My Towels. Also, we have bath sheets, bath towels, washcloths, hand towels, and so much more. And the best part, with your promo code, your entire order ships absolutely free. So go to MyPillow.com or call the number on your screen. Use that promo code to get deep discounts on all My Towels. And for a limited time, your order ships absolutely free.
All right. Those are two ads. Now I'm thinking here, since Gordon is clearly still working on the technical issues, I think we're just going to push through a little bit more and pretend it's 1995 when we were watching television and had to sit there and watch, you know, commercials beyond our control. And you know, just take a break, listen to the next couple of commercials, enjoy them, pick up some honey, actually. There's a sweet commercial coming up called on Benson Honey Farms. So let's go see what Benson has to say. All right, Benson Honey Farms, sale has extended. Indulge in the authentic, unpasteurized, 100% natural honey, a product of diligent bees working the fields of wildflowers. It's as raw and robust as the spirit of Badlands. When you're seeking a taste that's real, pure, and American, choose Benson Honey Farms, the sweetness born and bred in the heartland of Nebraska. Craving something sweet? Benson Honey's honey-fused candies capture the essence of Nebraska, each bite a delightful taste of home. And don't forget to try the goat's milk honey soap. Benson Honey Farms, a celebration of American first spirit, a symbol of the resilience of our homeland. Embodying the spirit of Badlands, their family-run operation is a reminder that the true flavor of America lies in its heartland. Benson Honey Farms, proudly American, naturally delicious. Visit badlandsmedia.tv/honey and use promo code HONEY15 to take 15% off of any purchase for a limited time. That is badlandsmedia.tv/honey, promo code HONEY15. Now, the final commercial is AeroTags. Okay, so these are AeroTags. Tired of the endless cycle of buying and tossing those paper tree air fresheners? Enter AeroTags, where their dream was to craft a solution to this very problem. AeroTags are the first ever laser-engraved, resentable car air refresheners made right here in the USA. Born in the makerspace of Cleveland Public Library, the Cleveland Public Library, really, AeroTags is not just a business, it's a revolution, a testament to the American dream. They are not just about freshening your space, but about doing it better, with a commitment to longevity, aesthetics, and sustainability. AeroTags are designed to last longer, look great, and reduce waste, replacing those fleeting scents with something you can count on. Choose AeroTags. Be part of a larger movement for a fresher, safer, and more sustainable world. Visit badlandsmedia.tv/AeroTags, AROTAGS, and use promo code BADLANDS for 10% off of your order. That's badlandsmedia.tv/AeroTags, promo code BADLANDS. So, all right. Those were the sponsors. And while Gordon is still waiting, I guess we'll just wax a little eloquent a little bit more on some of the topics that were just brought up that do have a very important bearing upon the world that we're living in, and also the future that is being shaped and is being fought over regarding what our children and grandchildren, those even unborn, will be living in going forward. Now, I think one of the important things that was implicit but not quite maybe clear enough is that I had touched upon before going into the commercials was that the New World Order agenda didn't succeed. That's a very important point that I think a lot that's been obscured, even amongst the truth-seeking networks that look for alternative histories that are more closely aligned to the truth, that acknowledge the existence of these multi-generational conspiracies. There's still a tendency to give the oligarchy more, assume that it has more power than it deserves. Now, the oligarchy is a very powerful thing. There is a quality of perverse brilliance, I gotta say, within the structures of oligarchical controls. Very, very somewhat impressive in a sick sort of way. But there's also some major Achilles heels, some major pathetic weak spots that have been used by people like Benjamin Franklin, by people like Thomas More, by people throughout history who have been able to organize processes that disrupt and derail the type of operating system desired by a feudal, depopulation-focused wannabe elite class. And one of the most important lessons that we could learn from is the period from the 30s and the 40s when we did have a plan to have a City of London, Wall Street run global fascist dictatorship under a eugenics doctrine. There was an occult element to it because obviously the Nazis weren't just a bunch of simple brutes. There was an inner secret society called the Thule Society. There was a new Templar order run out of Wevelsburg Castle, with people like Goering and Himmler, who were major, major occultists, as were most of the SS, who believed in some very, very disturbing things about the structure of physical space-time, the idea of an evil creator god who's made the world and us in his image. And to provide for one of the rituals that go into this type of occult behavioral setup is to do purgative violence, the killing especially of innocents that goes into preparing oneself for the grand theosophical sort of awakening for an inner elite. So this is something like one of the French cults of the 20s in Germany, of which there were many, that became thus the government. Imagine like Charles Manson becoming the government. That was kind of like what the Nazi thing was. The fact that it didn't succeed had a lot to do with the fact that you had a coalition of leadership that emerged into a position of influence within Russia, within the United States, within China, that didn't want to go along with that orientation and work together. I mean, it was the Chinese and the Russians that took on something together, like the Russians took on 90% of the entire Wehrmacht. They lost 25 million people. The Chinese lost 10 million. They took on a huge part of the majority of the Japanese fascists. So all this to say, Gordon is back. Gordon is back, and Gordon, I was just talking about how the New World Order was derailed back in the day, that people often don't appreciate how this occult, disgusting thing is not new. It was back then still going to be the governing occult operating system that was going to shape the New World Order, a new Roman Empire that was put down because courageous people who didn't want to, who had problems, they weren't perfect people, they had problems, but they were people being human first and foremost, and who decided as humans to do something about this death cult. And it forced now the oligarchy to reorganize themselves. And for 80 years, they've been working to try to undo the damage that was done by this pro-sovereign nation state coalition which said no one world government, sovereign nation states. That's why it was enshrined in the UN charter that was set up in 1945. Of course, the UN was infiltrated. I mentioned already UNESCO. That was an add-on to the UN as like a virus brought in to corrupt a host cell. But the UN was not League of Nations. As people say, it was a continuation of the League of Nations. It was not. It was a break. It, unlike the League of Nations earlier, which was the basis of a one world government, the UN, as it was formulated by Franklin Roosevelt and his allies, who was, by the way, assassinated. He was poisoned, no autopsy, and he died before he could oversee what the UN was going to become. But that enshrined the sacredness of sovereign nation states, the non-intervention of a strong nation into other countries. That was made illegal through the Nuremberg Code, but also in the actual charter itself. And that's why when you hear people like, you know, leaders of the multipolar alliance versus people like Ursula von der Leyen or Jens Stoltenberg, when you hear them talking about international law, it's like two different worlds. One side is talking about the UN charter needing to be protected. And that's the heart of the fight that I think you noticed a few elements at Davos. There are certain disruptive elements from the Saudis and others that were saying, no, we have to do things in a different way, or at the case of the International Court of Justice, versus this rules-based international order that we've heard so much about, but it doesn't seem to mean much. It's just the will of the stronger to make the rules that they see fit over the week, under a unipolar sort of game. But there's no real codification of what the rules-based international order is that Ursula represents or Klaus Schwab. So it's interesting to take the exercise to look at the historic backdrop of where these two sets of ideas of international law come from to begin with.
Yeah. Yeah, that's such an important distinction that you make, because that's a distinction I've been trying to make as well lately, as I talk about the ICJ, the Hague, as it's referred to, and the difference between that and what we conceive as globalism. Obviously, the UN, you probably already covered this, has been infiltrated. There's a lot of bad elements about the UN that we as nationalists, as populist nationalists, we don't like. That needs to be fixed. But at the same time, the idea of having an international court where you can go adjudicate differences instead of leaving it up to individual bilateral conflicts or negotiations or interfaces, because what you'll get then is you'll just get might makes right. You'll get the strong dominating the weak. And whereas if you have a court where you can go to adjudicate, lay out all the facts, present it to other countries, and have other countries weigh in, you know, you can resolve situations, and rather than allowing them to escalate to warfare and to conflict. So I do think there's value in that system. I don't think the system is right as it's set up right now is conducive to the multipolar system that we all want. But I do think we're working towards that. And a big part of that is what we're seeing from countries that we have been programmed to hate, such as China, Iran, Russia, you know, the African nations, the Asian countries that we have always, I feel like a lot of people in the West kind of dismiss as like corrupt backwater places. But I mean, when you look at the US government, I mean, is there anything more corrupt than the US government? So, I mean, who are we to cast those stones at other countries? So, really, really good points. And yeah, so have you covered anything specific about this Davos?
Not really. No, I was waxing eloquent about the past. So yeah. Still context. So if there was any, I know that you had a few insights that you wanted to share. So especially regarding the Saudi delegation, but other things, how did you read the developments so far?
Yeah, let's look real quick. I want to present this. I think this is an interesting. So Jake Sullivan, this is from today. So Jake Sullivan is out there saying the exact same rhetoric that the Saudi delegation is saying. Now, this for anyone who's been like following what I've been saying, what we've been saying on the show, this shouldn't be a shock to you. This is a big shock to like the media community, like the journalist community, that the Biden administration is like in lockstep with the Saudi delegation over this. But basically what Sullivan is saying that if you want like they told Netanyahu, if you want, and this article, which is Axios, it's not like this is coming from Steve Bannon. They're reporting that the Biden administration is growing frustrated with Netanyahu and the Israeli government. They don't feel like that the Israeli government are actually working in earnest to cultivate a peaceful resolution at the end of this whole situation with Palestine. And they basically told Netanyahu that if you want peace in the Middle East, if you want us to back you, you need to listen to Saudi Arabia and do a two-state solution with Palestine. And actually, specifically what Jake Sullivan said right here, the strategy post October 7 is that we want to see normalization between Israel and Saudi Arabia tied to a political horizon for the Palestinians. So what he said is, if you want peace between Israel and Saudi Arabia, which is the crux of peace in the Middle East, and I mentioned before when we talked about the Abraham Accords, I've mentioned on different shows that, you know, my theory on the Abraham Accords, the way the Abraham Accords came together is they were announced, I think, in 2018. They weren't signed until 2020. Jared Kushner is publicly credited for brokering them, but I'm fairly certain that it was really Mohammed bin Salman, who is very close with Jared Kushner. I think he's the one who actually brokered them. But basically, it was all the Arabian country, all the Arab countries around Israel, except for Saudi Arabia and Palestine. Those are the two countries, the two nation states, even though Palestine is technically a nation state yet, that were left out. And I think that was strategic. I think that was done intentionally because Palestine would have been a non-starter for Israel as far as negotiating the Abraham Accords. And at the same time, Saudi Arabia is like the heavyweight and the crux of the whole thing. Without Saudi Arabia in the treaty doesn't really make sense, and it's not really peace in the Middle East. So as soon as that was signed in May of 2020, which is when they got together and actually signed it, that was when Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, dispatched Faisal bin Farhan, who is the foreign minister, his foreign minister, and, you know, who I consider the captain of what I call Team Peace, the group of international leaders who are seeking this peaceful resolution. He dispatched him to begin the negotiations with Israel to normalize and reach a Israel-Saudi peace deal that started in 2020. So that was a three-year process that then culminated in the October 7th attack. So my thinking is that they understood that the Palestine situation, the two-state solution, which is part of that Saudi-Israel peace deal, that was basically going to be an ultimatum for the Netanyahu government, because the Netanyahu government is the most hyper-nationalist, right-wing, I guess you would call it. That's what the media calls it. It's not the same thing, by the way, as what we consider right-wing in America. What it really means is that they are Greater Israel, they like the Greater Israel Project, which is to expand the borders of Israel to Egypt to Iraq.
The way I see it is like the bad kind of right wing tends to participate. Yes. Like the kind that actually is fascist is like blood and soil cult. If you have that, there's different variations of the theme, but anything that has it, the Ukrainian right wing is a blood and soil cult that believes in a superiority of their blood because of some connection that they have to their soil that gives them a divine right to be considered a chosen people with their own perverse manifest destiny to spread and destroy the weak or subdue the weak. And we saw that also at the heart of a lot of, I think, the US's corruption too throughout the last 250 years is this strain of blood and soil cultism too that has sort of been there as part of the deep state ethic. So whenever there's like something terrible done as far as the massacre of natives, or like an evil version of like a takeover of like a weaker people under the name of Pax Americana in the 19th century or into the 20th, it's always done under this deep state, evil blood and soil sort of cult of the chosen people, the exceptional people, versus the actual idea of being, if you're going to be the exceptional people, America is exceptional. It's true. But that means you have to be extremely moral. The moral responsibilities are so high to be a beacon, a city on a hill, that people would want to emulate and look up to you as a role model. That means you have such a high standard to aim for. And if you fall short, it could be easily abused into empire. So that's just something as a coloring on the the nuance of the term right wing, good and bad.
For sure. And so I think a lot of Americans fall into the trap of seeing that kind of language, that coded language being used in the media of like the right wing government in Israel. And they think in their head, oh, well, it's a right wing government. Netanyahu and Trump appear to be friends on stage. So that must mean that they must be like me. They must have my values and that must be a conservative government. And so therefore I should like the Israeli government, but it's not the same thing. It's not the same thing at all. As far as the false paradigm we've been given in America is not the same paradigm they necessarily operate. And basically it's like the right wing in Israel is like, we're going to destroy Palestine and annex it. And the left wing is like, let's have a two-state solution and get along with everybody. So where we are with Davos is you have Sullivan coming in and saying Netanyahu, ball's in your court, but we are very frustrated with the way you're acting. We don't like the direction this is all going in. That's being communicated. There are a lot of people like in Iran, Russia, China, who have been saying to the media, like, hey, the Americans are talking out of both sides of their mouth. When they hold domestic press conferences, when they speak to the press, they're puffing out their chest and acting like we're going to war in Gaza. And when they call us on private lines, they're basically begging for peace and they're begging Israel to stop because they know they're getting crushed by their constituency. Like optically, it's not working out for them. Obviously, you have like the entire Democrat or most of the Democrat constituency in a total revolt right now in America against Biden in support of Palestine. Which is fantastic to see, but it's amazing to see the confluence of all these factors. So I want to play a video now. It's only a minute long. This is also from today. So this is after Jake Sullivan spoke. Faisal bin Farhan, this is the Saudi foreign minister. Most people who have been following me probably aren't going to recognize him because he's not wearing his thob and kafia. He's not wearing the headdress and robe. He's actually wearing like a suit and tie. Worth noting that Faisal bin Farhan is from, even though he's a true Arab, he's a true royal member of the House of Saud. He was born and raised in West Germany during the Cold War in the 70s. And so he has a European background. He's a European upbringing, despite being an Arab. So I think he's very much at home, like in Europe, like coming to these kind of meetings and speaking to these people. He's not like a fish out of water, like a lot of his relatives would be. He actually is at home. And I think that actually played into why Mohammed bin Salman picked him to do this as opposed to others. But let me play this video real quick. Let me know if you can't hear the sound on this, by the way. Oh, wait. Nope. Okay. Hold on one second. I'm going to share it a different way.
Okay. You do a screen share or like,
I'm going to share my whole screen and share the audio. I think that's the better way to do it.
Need to do is translate that.
Is that playing?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Good.
I think what's important to note here is that there is general agreement. What we need to do is translate that agreement into concrete action. Minister Baerbock very eloquently discussed the fact that peace and security for Israel is intimately linked with peace and security for the Palestinians. And that's something that we have supported in the kingdom since 1981, the FaZe proposal on peace. So we are fully on board with that. We agree that regional peace includes peace for Israel, but that can only happen through peace for the Palestinians through a Palestinian state. And I hear from Senator Coons exactly the same sentiment. And this is something that we have been indeed working on with the administration, the US administration. And it continues, I think it's even more relevant in the context of Gaza. The fact is that what Israel is doing now is putting the prospects for regional peace and security at risk. There is a pathway towards a much better future for the region, for the Palestinians and for Israel, that is peace. And we are fully committed to that. But again, the first step for that is ceasefire. And I will say that a ceasefire, of course, means ceasefire on all sides. But that can only happen as should be a starting point towards a permanent sustainable peace, which can only happen through true justice for the Palestinian people.
Yeah, so very interesting. I mean, obviously that rhetoric aligns perfectly with what Jake Sullivan said, which, you know, you can read into that however you can, however you may. The way I read it is that the Saudis are really the ones running the show here. And the Biden administration is basically just holding on for dear life and trying to just survive politically. I don't think the Biden administration really has a lot of political leverage right now on the international stage. I don't think it's respected in any way by anybody. Obviously our military has been depleted. There's lots of reports, like with going back to the Ukraine conflict, about us being short on ammunition. We've missed like recruiting goals, like all this stuff. So we are in no shape, which like a lot of generals have come out and said this, like retired generals, that we're in no shape to go to war right now. We certainly can't go to war with multiple countries, like in the Middle East, like Iran, Turkey, which is what, you know, the current rhetoric is. So, I do think that the whole world is basically coalescing against Israel right now in The Hague. We'll talk about that in a minute. But really, more importantly, the Muslim world is coalescing around Saudi Arabia. We've talked about that in the past. Saudi Arabia is the leader of the Muslim world right now. So despite all of this rhetoric coming out about Iran, I don't buy any of that. I need to see proof before anything happens between the U.S. and Iran. I need to see definitive proof that Iran is actually behind these proxy militias that they claim, because I've read reports from the past year that actually say the opposite, that say, despite the fact that they've sent them funding and that they have connections from the past, they don't really have any direct control over them. You know, I think it's very, very possible that the Houthis, if they aren't being run by like the CIA or Mossad, which I think is also the most likely probably explanation, they could just be acting in earnest. They could just be seeing this and saying, you know what, we've been fighting the Saudis since 2015. All eyes are on the Middle East right now. This is our best shot to basically wage war against Israel. That could be what's happening, but I think it's more likely that they're probably being like some strings being pulled by some nefarious intelligence agencies. Right. But that's a different discussion. I think that Iran is on the same page as Saudi. I don't think Iran is trying to have a war with the U.S. I do think Iran wants to see the U.S. regime, like what they call the Great Satan, and they've actually been pretty articulate about that and saying the Great Satan, they don't consider the people, the American people, to be the Great Satan. They consider the American government in D.C. to be the Great Satan. When they say the Great Satan, that's what they're referring to. I can't say I disagree with them. So, yeah. I do think that the Muslim world is actually on the same page. I don't. Right now, I see the media trying to stoke flames between Sunni and Shia and Saudi and Iran. I don't think it's going to happen.
I'd add one little thought as you're speaking about that struck my mind was Kissinger. Because remember, Trump fired Kissinger in, I think, November of 2020. Mm-hmm. And also a variety of other high-level deep state operatives, high priest folks. Now, Kissinger was, though he says that the greatest accomplishments of Trump, he applauds the Abraham Accords. There's a specific variation of it that Kissinger was trying to reframe it as and rebrand it to be, which it was never intended to be and is not even now, which was something, like Kissinger said, it was a great grand strategy of Trump that he did that because it pit the Sunni world against Iran and the Shia world. That was the way that Kissinger wanted to rebrand it. Now, that was never the case. And as we see it now, the Shia Iran nation is working, has joined fully the BRICS plus, so has Saudi Arabia, so has the UAE. And there's been a rebuilding of diplomatic ties also with Turkey and Iran, and Turkey being another Sunni country with Iran that's been rebuilding their ties, ending their rivalries. And we've had this harmonization of agreement around the idea that we need to find a way to find, as the Saudi foreign minister just said in that speech, we need to find pathways into the future that are viable, of which the Abraham Accords creates that space by allowing for a return back to that discussion that we were having in the 90s regarding a two-state solution. For starters, economic development is the key that would make it work. And, you know, the problem, I think, with Netanyahu is that there are elements to you're dealing with like a psych case, right? It's like a trauma psych case. Netanyahu has this is so difficult to speak to because it's such a mixed bag, right, of freaks and and racists. But also at the same time, there was a reason why Yuval Harari was leading the charge to topple Netanyahu some months back regarding the Supreme Court reforms that Netanyahu was trying to force through to allow for the executive branch of the government to make decisions that would bypass a generally very technocratic-leaning Supreme Court system inside of Israel. And you had mass protests. And the fact that Yuval Harari was leading those has confused a lot of people, thinking, well, maybe Yuval Harari is not all that bad. You know, he was. And it's like, no, if they were successful, I'm quite persuaded that had they successfully toppled Netanyahu, there would not have been a need to do an inside job like an October 7th and initiate this entire cataclysmic set of destructive actions that have killed so many people in Palestine and Gaza. That was needed because it didn't, their original plan to do a color revolution, in a sense, to install a more controllable, technocratic Israel, didn't work out. So now they're playing this other card, bringing about the worst elements of Israel and the more sane elements within Israel that wanted economic development with Russia, with China, that was more open to the discussions, that wanted the Abraham Accords. You know, all he had to do, Russia was with Trump and in agreeing to move their embassies to Jerusalem. That was very controversial. That was a tough pill for a lot of people to swallow, but they did it because it was part of appeasing this, like, how do you tame this very potentially dangerous chosen people grouping that has a sort of zealotry about them? But how do you tame that and make it, convert it into something that isn't destructive, but it could participate in the good? That requires a very delicate touch. And I think the Saudis are recognizing it. They're not taking the belligerent, you know, language. They're taking a very, very tempered language. They still want to bring in a peaceful resolution to this, even though a lot of people are losing their hearts a little bit. They're getting demoralized. They're getting shocked by the loss of innocent lives. It's very, very painful to watch.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's important to just really realize that all of human civilization is hanging in the balance. If somebody missteps, we have an economic collapse that could easily be triggered by any of these elements.
Mm-hmm.
Going on the shutdown of the Suez Canal, it's already kind of happening indirectly through what's going on in the Red Sea around Yemen. That could be a something that does a chain reaction blowout. The withholding of oil from Saudi Arabia to the world markets, that could be the thing that is the thing that pushes everything off the cliff. There's so many points that could usher in an accelerated drive for thermonuclear World War III, because when you're in an economic collapse, there's a limited amount of time to maintain your power structures, in which usually involves massive all-out war and trying to reorganize the chaos or control the chaos, which in the case of thermonuclear weaponry is not going to be that's not workable. Not that it's ever been workable even before thermonuclear weaponry, but now it's really, really, really not. And again, all of civilization is hanging in the balance of these decisions being made right now. So it's very important to hold that in mind.
Yep. Well, and it's important to note on that, you know, the Samson option, which is a real thing. We don't know if it's something that's like, you know, we don't know if it's something that's just in the archives or something that's actually like in the discussion in terms of, you know, the order of war. But they do talk about the Samson option. And for those who don't know what that is if Israel feels like it is about to be existentially destroyed, it will nuke everybody, including the United States. It's just fire nukes at everybody, all its allies, all its enemies, destroy everybody. And the idea is that if its allies know that that's on the table, the allies will rush in to make sure that Israel is not destroyed. That's a part of like the leverage, the coercion, the blackmail, which, you know, ties into the Epstein stuff. All this stuff is connected. And when you say that everything hangs in the balance right here, I think that's spot on. I think this situation right here is the most important thing happening in the world right now. I think it directly connects with everything happening domestically in America right now. Everything that's happening in the news media right now with Epstein and all the other stuff. I think all this stuff is connected. I don't think it's a coincidence that all this is happening at the same time. And how the situation gets resolved is extremely important, because it is the difference between thousands of people dying, which has already happened, or millions of people dying, which could still happen.
Or billions of people.
Or billions of people dying, which could also happen.
Van der Leyen kind of wants the end of the day, because I think, again, 500 million to a billion is all that is supposed to exist to be sustainable. So how to get there is a big question.
And you brought up a really interesting point, which I'll just touch on, and then we can move on to The Hague. But you brought up the moving of the embassy. I brought this up at GART 2 in Florida. And this was, of course, in September before the October 7th attack. But I just said how the media sold that to us back in 2017 as this terrible affront to Muslims. Like it was Trump basically attacking Muslims by moving the embassy, the American embassy from Tel Aviv, which is a settlement that was founded in 1909 and incorporated as a city in the 1950s by Britain. He wanted to move it from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is right on the line there of where like Palestine and Israel meet. And this was this terrible insult to Muslims. Turns out the Muslims, that's exactly what they want. It wasn't a Jew-Muslim conflict. Like, it was a Satan-God conflict, because the Satanists all reside in Tel Aviv, just like they reside in DC and New York and LA. And the actual God-fearing people reside in Jerusalem, which is what, that's why the symbolism there was never Muslim versus Jew. It was God versus Satan. And that's what I've said back in September. And I think that's exactly what was behind it.
That's an interesting observation. I hadn't really thought about it framed that way. That's very useful.
And then just think about, there's a 2009 Boston Globe article you can go find that talks about how Tel Aviv is the gayest city on earth. It's the most degenerate city on earth. It's the most godless city on earth. Not a coincidence, I don't think so.
Interesting.
But moving on to The Hague. Right now we have the International Court of Justice. They are holding a court case. What has happened is you have back in November, I think the 84 page application was drafted by South Africa. South Africa is one of the BRICS members. It wasn't, I think, formally submitted until December, but this is an 84 page application accusing Israel of genocide in Gaza. So I believe a hearing date has been set for February, but what happened was South Africa said, hey, in the spirit of speeding this thing along and trying to save lives in Gaza, instead of focusing on adjudicating whether this was a genocide, we're asking the court to first have a preliminary hearing to decide whether there is merit to our application. And if there is, if you feel like this is potentially a genocide, provide affirmation and in the form of an injunction against Israel, forcing a ceasefire until we can adjudicate the genocide question. So basically stop all activity, stop all wartime activity. Let's adjudicate the case. If it's not genocide and it's legitimate warfare, then they can continue. But if it is genocide, obviously they have to stop. Let's stop right now, adjudicate the case in February, and then we can. So last week, I believe it was starting on Wednesday, I think South Africa presented their case on Wednesday, maybe Thursday as well. And then Israel came back on Friday and I think Saturday and presented their defense. It was like a 3.5 hour presentation by South Africa. I've listened to most of it. I have gone and read I've read through the notes. I want to share the original application real quick, because I think that there's some really, really good stuff in here that people are gonna latch onto. So the ICJ has 15 members to it. You have to have 8 rule yes in your favor in order to get passage or whatever. I went through with the list of members with CanCon on Badlands Daily last week. If you go back and listen to the Monday, anyone listening to this, if you go back and listen to the Monday episode from last week, I actually go through and talk about each country and the supposition, you know, the speculation as to what side they're going to go to. Basically, it comes down to everyone thinks, like all of the experts or the people who are analyzing this think that it's going to be a 7-7 split with France being the deciding vote as to whether to grant the ceasefire. I actually disagree with that. I do think that France is going to go with South Africa and say that, yes, it is a genocide. But the arguments being made by this analysis was that China and Russia were going to abstain from voting, which is effectively a no vote, because they're worried about the politics of when they're brought in front of The Hague for Ukraine and Russia and the Uyghur Muslims and China. They don't want to have this blowback on them. I don't buy that. I actually think that China and Russia are both, considering the rhetoric coming out of both those places right now by their leaders, including Putin, including Xi, I do think that China and Russia are both going to side with South Africa. BRICS is obviously another good reason why that would be. And I think if they do that, then France becomes irrelevant. And that's already eight right there. So
yeah. I just add one thing on that is those who are framing that narrative that you just outlined, which is totally false, that they're going to refrain because they're afraid of having a light on their own genocide acts against the that they've committed. This all comes from this assumption that we are supposed to believe that the International Court of Justice, which is currently the thing that is, you know, being used, is the same thing as another entity that was created in 1998, also existing in The Hague, called the International Criminal Court, funded by George Soros, Mark Malik Brown, and the entire apparatus that overthrew the U.S. elections back in 2020. So they want to try to blur the line and make it seem like these are two sides of the same entity, and it's not. These are two very different things. This one is the International Court of Justice was created in 1946, and is a direct outgrowth that is obedient to the UN Charter, the idea of sovereign nation states. Every nation has a say in its policy overall, even though it's 18 members directly that are tied to the UN Security Council. The International Criminal Court, funded by Soros, is a private NGO entity with the masquerading as if it's somehow an official thing that put out arrest warrants for Putin and President Bashir and is criticizing China for all of the U.S. State Department propaganda. So it's, yeah, not at all. Not at all the same thing.
Very interesting. Okay. Well, yeah, so that's, you know, I heard about the International Court, Criminal Court and the ICJ, and I didn't realize, so those are two different things. And it's interesting that Soros, I learned something today. Soros is the one who started the ICC. So, okay. So this is, if you can see my screen, this PDF, this is the application from South Africa. And so the South Africa is part of a group known as the Genocide Convention. And that's why, so they explain in this like opening prologue that that's the reason that they're the ones who took the initiative to do this, is because they're part of a council known as the Genocide Convention. And they felt that because they're part of it, it is their prerogative and their responsibility to call out genocide when they see it. So, and I'm going to do a thread on this on X, probably maybe tomorrow. I've already kind of gone through and cultivated the screenshots. So keep an eye out for that. But I just wanted to kind of go over some of the things that they're saying here, because this thing is so much more thorough and so much more like juicy than I would have ever expected from something like this. So this is like the opening argument, which they got up and read on Wednesday, and they say, in our application, South Africa has recognized the ongoing Nakba. So the Nakba is the was the term for the original invasion of Israel by Britain back in 1948. So they say the ongoing Nakba of the Palestinian people through Israel's colonization since 1948, which has systematically and forcibly dispossessed, displaced, and fragmented the Palestinian people, deliberately denying them their internationally recognized inalienable right to self-determination and their internationally recognized right of return as refugees to their towns and villages in what is now the state of Israel. So what they're saying right there is they're basically saying is they view the past 76 years since 1948 as one continuous military campaign. They're not distinguishing between, you know, the different conflicts. Though they do make a distinction here in a minute, in a second, about the different activities that have occurred over the past 76 years, but they're basically saying this is one like invasion campaign. This is one ongoing campaign since 1948. And so down here they say, the application places Israel's genocidal acts and omissions within the broader context of Israel's 75-year apartheid, 56-year occupation, and 16-year siege imposed on the Gaza Strip, a siege which itself has been described by the director of, and that's the United Nations the regional works
Too many acronyms.
That's the thing that runs the public school system in Palestine. Okay. I know that. Anyway, affairs in Gaza as, quote, a silent killer of people, end quote. I thought that, like, I underlined that because I thought that was really fascinating that they're actually, there's the 75-year apartheid, which is the Nakba, the 56-year occupation, they're referring to, I believe, the Six-Day War, which 1967, that was when the IDF actually occupied the West Bank and they still have not left. So to this day, the Israeli military occupies and patrols the streets of the West Bank, which is the larger part of Palestine, and the 16-year siege imposed on the Gaza Strip, which began, I believe, in that would have been what, in 2007? About 2007.
That was when Hamas was elected.
That would have been when Hamas was elected, which of course we know Netanyahu helped that happen. He orchestrated that.
Yeah.
So I won't go through, just keep an eye out for the thread that I'm going to do on this. But what I found really fascinating about this application is the way they go about doing it. And I've seen some analysis on this from some South African politicians who were former prosecutors. And they said that they read through it and they were like, this thing is amazing, which is why I decided to read through it. And it really is extremely thorough. It doesn't speak like in broad generalities. It actually gets very, very specific. It's very, very well cited, very, very well sourced. It goes through and it talks about, it quotes Netanyahu and all of his cabinet members ever since October 7th, the language they're using, the stuff they're saying in their public, statements. Right here, for example, it says Prime Minister Netanyahu in his address to the Israeli forces on 28 October 2023, preparing for the invasion of Gaza, urged his soldiers to, quote, remember what Amalek has done to you, end quote. This refers to the biblical command by God to Saul for the retaliatory destruction of an entire group of people known as the Amalekites, I had a tongue twister there. Quote, put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys, end quote. The genocidal invocation to Amalek was anything but idle. It was repeated by Mr. Netanyahu in a letter to the Israeli Armed Forces on 3 November 2023. Madam President, let the Prime Minister's words speak for themselves. So they go through and they do that to every single person on his cabinet. They go through and they use their own words against them.
Wow.
They then also go through, because, you know, I'm sure anyone who's been on social media since October 7th has seen all the crazy stuff that's been posted. A lot of it is awful. Most of it's probably fake. I mean, I basically have adopted the position that I just assume every single thing that I'm looking at is wartime propaganda, and which is why I don't share it. Like, I don't retweet. I generally speaking, unless it's something very, very specific, I don't like retweet it because I don't want to perpetuate wartime propaganda. But you know, obviously a lot of that stuff is probably real. It's just hard to know what's real and what isn't. So they actually are going through and citing a lot of those social media posts, a lot of those articles. They actually have like timestamps on all of them on when they were posted, who they were posted by. They have social media posts that are posted by IDF soldiers, where they're sitting there singing, they're dancing as they're blowing up people's houses, as they're executing civilians, they're laughing in their face. They're calling out the fact that Israel, which is, you know, this is stuff that was written off by the Western media as like propaganda, but Israel was telling the Palestinians, go to this location, this is your safe spot, this is your refugee spot, we're about to bomb the city, And then all these people would gather in this one spot, and then the IDF would bomb that spot and kill everybody. Or you had snipers, you know, shooting off kids' hands and shooting like civilians, shooting women and children, like with their sniper rifles, calling them out for that. And then taking videos of it and posting it online, bragging about it. So you have a very, very thorough, like specific case that is not using generalities. It's actually using specific evidence against Israel. So I do think this is a very damning application. I do think it's something that is going to, I expect, I mean, who knows what's going to happen in February at the actual genocide adjudication case. But now that South Africa has presented this preliminary case, preliminary hearing, Israel has come back with this defense, and Israel's defense is kind of what you would expect. They said that, you know, they're cherry picking stuff. They're taking things out of context. They don't understand our plight. They're not allowing us, you know, the right to self-defense, et cetera. We've all heard those arguments in the media. But I wonder, what an interesting situation. We're going to get a little speculative here, a little conspiratorial, but I can't help but wonder what happens if in this preliminary injunction or adjudication, if the Hague rules against Israel and basically says, all right, you have to have a ceasefire, stop all activity until we can adjudicate the actual genocide case. What happens if Israel and its two backers, which are the United States and Britain, what if the three of them basically flip the bird at the UN and say, you know what, at the end of the day, y'all really don't have any means of enforcing this, and they don't. Like, this is not an enforceable thing. This is the court can rule against them, but it's really the prerogative of the other member nations of the UN to actually step up and do something if the instigator doesn't follow the ruling of the court. Mm-hmm. How ironic would it be if Israel and the United States and Britain stand up and basically say, yeah, you know what, we don't really buy any of this. We're not going to listen to you. You have no authority here. And what's happening right now is you already have the pro-Palestine side, which is basically the rest of the world outside of those three countries, standing up and saying and arguing in public right now, saying that the UN is not a legitimate organization because it has failed up till now to step in and stop the genocide. Like, why didn't it step in October and stop this? Like, why, like, how can it sit there and profess to be the UN if it can't even stop a genocide from occurring, like, while it's happening, right? So it's really interesting. We might fall into a situation where we have both sides arguing opposite cases, a genocide versus a legitimate, like legitimate warfare, disagreeing on that one point, but agreeing on the fact that the UN is an illegitimate organization that really has no power or jurisdiction over individual sovereign nations. If we get to that point, man, that right there is the death kiss of globalism. I mean, that's the kiss of death that you don't even need Donald Trump for that to happen. So who knows that actually comes to fruition, but it's a dynamic that I've been watching to evolve over the past 2 months. And I'm just wondering, like, is that what actually is going to happen? You know, and then let me make this other point, and then I'll pass it on to you to kind of respond to all this. The other thing I would just say is going back to the Davos stuff that we were talking about before, it's hard for me to look at this case unfolding right now at The Hague, which obviously I think Saudi Arabia has come out and formally endorsed. I think 15 countries have come out and formally endorsed South Africa's application. Saudi Arabia is one of them. Iran is another one. The timing of it, where you have this case unfolding at the ICJ, at the same time you have Davos happening, and at the 11th hour, the Saudi foreign minister is like, oh yeah, I'm rolling in the Davos, by the way, with an enormous entourage for the purpose of, quote, making a significant impact and disrupting the routine of like this retreat. And then they show up and basically are like, yeah, if you want peace in the Middle East, if you want a stabilized region, Israel, you got to step down and stop killing people, and you have to basically give Palestine their autonomy. And then you have the United States also showing up and saying the exact same thing. Very interesting. I just, it's hard to know what's going to happen, man, but there's just some interesting things happening.
Yeah, I appreciate the analysis, and I'm going to refrain from speculating on the mechanics of it, because there's so many moving parts, and I just feel like I'm not a fly on a wall in enough of the backroom chambers to necessarily have a well-formed idea. But I would also add that another aspect of this too that's also important is that Zelensky was also featured prominently on at Davos, basically acting the fool as always in a completely lost cause to try to bring about this Western-led peace proposal, which was supposed to involve China. And he has been trying to beg China, which is a key ally of Russia, to be a part of this U.S. version of the peace proposal. Now, China has already laid forth their own peace proposal for Ukraine, and it's much more in alignment with Putin's general outline of what is supposed to happen as far as like declaring absolute neutrality, having some form of denazification, recognizing all of the parts of Ukraine that voted to join Russia, let them join Russia, acknowledge it, stop disputing Crimea and Donbass and all these things. It is what it is. They did a plebiscite. They did a vote. China said no. And they were like, okay, well, let's do it at Davos. And that way the Chinese delegation won't be able to get around or avoid it. And the Chinese delegation avoided it. They were like, no. So you have all of these different things, the breakdown of so many plans all kind of happening in their own ways. Plans that look good when they were being game theoried, they look good on the whiteboard and then put into action. All of a sudden, reality did not respond the way that these oligarchical planners who think of the world like a big video game anticipated. Nothing's kind of working. So you're getting a lot of backtracking. I personally am not as optimistic about the Blinken or the machinery behind what's behind Blinken's remarks. Maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe. I don't know about the 15,000 troops, because I know you have a surge as well of U.S. troops into Syria and Iraq. As well, that has probably a lot to do with Iran having bombed a couple of U.S. proxy terrorist-ridden bases in Idlib, in northern Syria, which is the Idlib province. That's the base of operations of ISIS.
And Mossad. They also bombed the Mossad station as well.
Yes, they did. And same in Iraq. Yeah. So now in response, mm-hmm. You have this flight forward release of more U.S. troops into the zone. I mean, each one is potentially a sitting duck. There's a lot of points of potential conflict where if you start killing U.S. troops now, what does that give to the Nikki Haley faction that wants to see some U.S.? They're happy to have some sacrificial, a few hundred or a few thousand U.S. troops die. They have no problem watching U.S. citizens die in favor of a geopolitical end, which usually involves bombing the hell out of Iran. So there's that whole chaos factor. I don't really fully understand how to think about that in all of its detail, but definitely there are patriots in America that don't want this to go down that path and do want to put out this fire. And we have patriots in Asia and Russia and across the Arab world and Africa and beyond. So, God, I mean, it's a very interesting time. And I would just say for people, read things. Like, I mean, what Gordon just did is an exercise of this 84-page report. It's publicly available. I cannot emphasize the importance of just reading some of these types of source, like, material. It takes maybe 45 minutes to an hour. Sit down, work it through. And then that way, when you speak with your friends or neighbors or you're writing about it, or the ideas take on a deeper root because you've done the work, you've lifted the heavier weights, mentally speaking, and you thus will find yourself building up more mental muscles than just having read a summary about something given to you by even a trusted media outlet. That summarizing things is not the same thing as just clicking on the link or going to find that South African report, going to find that Chinese government report about outlining British intelligence operations in China. Like, just read the thing, and you'll usually be gratified. You'll be rewarded for it in ways you can't even imagine, and be smarter for it too. You'll be able to speak with much more weight carrying that each of your words is carrying by having done that work, and not just like there was a show. Remember when we were kids, reading Rainbow with Jordan from Star Trek?
Oh yeah,
don't trust. Sure. Don't take our words for it. Read the book.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I do remember that. I forgot that guy was from Star Trek, wasn't he?
Yeah, now he's a woke fool. But that's unfortunate. Yeah. But that Reading Rainbow guy was, always will have a special place in my heart.
Big thumbs up from the Reading Rainbow guy for sure. Yeah. But I mean, as far as what happens from here, I mean, I don't want to misrepresent. I don't think that Blinken, I don't have a lot of faith in that. I don't think they're actually working in earnest to be like good guys or anything like that. I think that they have their balls in a vice right now because Saudi Arabia basically has the American economy, or the US dollar, I should say, hanging on by a thread. And they have the power basically to crush the petrodollar if they want to. We also are like completely dependent on them and others in their orbit for oil. So, you know, it's like those are kind of like leverage points that maybe are being exercised against guys like Blinken to make them do things that they maybe don't want to do, or maybe their backers don't want them to do. So I agree with you. It's a total question mark. Like, what is going on in the American government? We don't know. The American government, I think, is a complete enigma right now. It's hard to say what's what. And then you obviously have people like Nikki Haley gunning for the White House, who would love nothing more than just to see the Middle East nuked, I think. So it's a very interesting time, but also a very dangerous time.
Absolutely. So I think on that note, we'll end with a word from Vladimir Putin about commenting about the U.S. election process.
Наверное, можно все сфальсифицировать, так как в Соединенных Штатах фальсифицировали предыдущие выборы через голосование по почте. Ну, понятно, что это голосование по почте. Скупали за $10 бюллетени, вписывали и без всякого наблюдения со стороны.
That's really thought that was a nice way to...
A question. Did we do all four ads?
Yeah, I did. When you were doing your technical difficulty thing, I just ran through them all.
I hope that didn't screw up the episode. My internet actually went out. We're having like a really bad snowstorm here, and Virginia just is really bad when it comes to snow. We're not like Canada.
It's a miracle. So. It's a miracle that then you had no internet, but I could interface with you just fine.
It's weird. Dude, I said some really, really mean things about the CIA at GART this weekend, so I can't help but wonder if maybe that's part of it, but we'll see.
Well, they're not known for their forgiving attributes, so yeah, maybe. All right, Gordon, always a pleasure. I hope everyone enjoyed this, and tune back in next week, the same time for the people watching, Wednesdays noon Eastern time, and we'll have a lot more to talk about. So till next
time. Hit the thumbs up, everyone. Thanks for watching.